Welcome to The Advisor with Stacey Chalemi, where we dive deep into personal transformation, emotional resistance, and the stories that define who we are. Today, I'm honored to have Andrew Kirkland as our guest, a man whose life journey is nothing short of astonishing. Andrew is the author From Kingpin to Kingdom. It's a gripping memoir that chronicles of his transformation from a multi-state drug trafficker, managing his empire of 78 million in annual drug sales, to a redeemed man devoted to sharing God's message of grace, hope, and transformation. His life once revolved around money, power, survival in the streets, but one desperate prayer capulated him into a new chapter of his redemption, faith, and purpose. Today, Andrew leads a Bible studies. He volunteers in prisons, and he speaks to audiences from all walks of life, shining a light in the darkest corners and proving that no one is too far gone for God's grace. In this powerful conversation, we're going to dig deep into Andrew's rise and fall, the emotional wounds beneath the surface, and why people self-destruct even when they seem successful, and how faith can rewrite even the most broken stories. So get ready for some raw honesty, some jaw-dropping moments, and plenty of inspiration. And I am so excited to have you on today. It's an honor. I really admire, what you've gone through in life and, where you are today. Looking back on your old life as someone who ran a $78 million drug empire, what drove you into that lifestyle? Was it the money, the validation, or something deeper?
Oh, well, thank you, Stacey. I'm so glad to be here. It's an honor that you chose me to be on your podcast, and looking forward to our conversation. 78 million is a stretch. It was 7.8,
Okay.
it's still quite a bit.
Quite a bit.
Yeah, I came away with 10% in profit on my own every year. So, what drove me was ultimately, a deep desire for acceptance and approval that was missing from my childhood. Even if you have a superstar mom, if your dad is a bum, or let's just reverse the roles, then it leaves a big gap in your heart. And when people don't understand that, when they don't have proper counselors or people that listen and can nurture that pain, then it manifests in all types of ways, whether that's drug addiction, sexual addiction, taking 1,000 selfies every day for likes, whatever it manifests in. For me, it was I needed to find a group of people that said, "I'm proud of you, you're valued, and you're one of us," because acceptance is our number one need, and rejection is our number one fear. And so I used drugs as a means of finding my acceptance.
Wow, that's powerful. Now, you've mentioned some feelings of untouchable during your drug trafficking days. Was there a moment when you felt that cracks were starting to show?
Oh yeah. So at the height, dealing 50 pounds of marijuana a week, I believe I drew some attention from the police, and I lived in the Metro Nashville, Davidson County area. And there was a point in time where I had two police, one unmarked and one marked, parked in my neighborhood, watching my house on a daily basis. It was nervous was a very small way of saying it. I was under an extreme amount of anxiety and pressure. I even took all the drugs and money and got another house, what we call in the drug world a stash house, and then started operating there. But that imminent danger, and I always used to say, "I'm smart, but I'm not smarter than a room full of cops." So all that has to happen is either me or one of my partners making one mistake, and it'll all come crumbling down. So you've been to the dentist to get an X-ray, and those lead vests that they put on you. That's how I felt 24/7. And I smoked copious amounts of marijuana, which usually for the average person can relax you. But for me, it was, I was under so much stress from it that I wasn't feeling high ever.
Wow. Now, what emotional wounds unmet were needs were you trying to fill while chasing the power of validation in your in the streets?
Great question. My father rejected me over and over and over again. Even though my parents were married until I was 13, he was gone away from the house with other women more than he was at home. So I was his fourth child in his third marriage, and there was many words that he would say, "You're my favorite child. I love you. I love you the most," but there were never any actions that followed it. And so many times, Stacy, he would promise to come and pick me up, promise to come and take me somewhere. But these were the days before cell phones, before beepers. So you just had to wait on somebody. And I remember so many times that I'd be outside until the sun went down, and my mom would come outside and grab me and say, "He's not coming." And it's bad enough for that to happen once, but for that to be cemented into your identity over and over again, that left me saying, "There's something wrong with me. What is it that I'm doing that's making me unlovable, that my dad doesn't want to spend time with me?" So it really culminated down when I joined the Navy to be like my dad. He was a 20-year veteran, and I remember I'm 21 years old, and I can't we our my ship went from Norfolk down to Florida. That's where my dad lived, and I called him and I told him that we were going to come in. This is an aircraft carrier, so it's a big deal. And I said, "I'd really like for you to come." And he agreed, right? And so I believed him, always believed him. The day came where the ship ported in Jacksonville, and I called my dad, and he didn't answer, and I kept calling. I eventually called one of my half brothers, and he answered, and he said the same thing I'd heard all my life. He's with a woman. And I had blocked this memory out, but my mom, I called my mom right after that, and she told me what happened. And what I said was, "He didn't show up. No one will ever hurt me again." And at that moment, something switched in my mind. It's what they call psychopathy. And I stopped feeling emotions other than pleasure and anger from that point on. And I went into this autopilot mode of seeking validation and approval from anyone that would give it to me. So that's the path that led me to where I'm at today.
Wow. Now, can you share the story behind the desperate prayer that changed your life?
Definitely. So fast forward. I'm in my mid 30s, and I'm making 60,000 a month, and I've done that for years. Making 10% of 7.8 million will give you everything, and I found it completely empty. Once the materialism was, I'd have everything that I wanted. Nothing made me happy. The sexual relationships were no longer gratifying, and that timing between having sex and needing it again became instantaneous. And I realized that the way I was living was without purpose. It was only taking, and I was tired of being angry and unfulfilled in life. I grew up in the church, and I grew up knowing God through Jesus, and I hadn't talked to God since I was 13. I dropped my son off at school, and I was just driving, and I had this yearning to pull over and talk to God, and I believe that was from God. And I cried out to him, and I said, "I haven't talked to you in 20 years, and I don't know what to say, and I'm crying." And I said, I just repented. I wanted to turn from the way I was, and I said, I'm an evil person. I admitted who I was. And I asked him for help, and I said, I kind of made a bargain with God. I said, "If you can get me out of this, I'm at the top of the ladder. If you can get me out of this, my life is yours. I'm yours." And that was the prayer. And He made it come true in a wild way.
Now, what led you to say those words? God, if you can get me out of it, out of this alive, I'll give you my life.
Those words are rooted in the faith of Christianity. It's about surrender. It's God gave his life for us so that we
Right.
could give it to him. And the purpose of our life is to give our lives to God. It's and the book I read, The Purpose Driven Life, the first words are, it's not about you. And that was astonishing to me. So I knew that it was all about surrendering the control of my life and giving over what they call the lordship or the control of my life to his life. And I had never done that before. As a child, you don't really understand what lordship is. You live under your parents' authority, and it's giving up your control and giving it over to that higher power so that he can start calling the shots. It's getting out of the front seat, driver's seat, getting into the back seat. And saying, what purpose would you have me do with this life that you have given me? This time, this talent, and this treasure is now yours. And I started practicing living that out, which is the Christian walk is not easy, because he's built his image onto us, and that means we want lordship, we want control of everything. So it's an everyday struggle of getting over that. I'm in control and handing it over to him.
Now, so you spoke of, so after you spoke the prayer, how did you begin to see God's word in your life? Like, were these moments when you doubted the process or yourself, like, when you go deeper into it, what were those moments when you started to go through the doubting process?
So 2 weeks after that prayer, I had weekly trips. I would send my driver to Colorado to pick up 50 pounds of marijuana. He would take $115,000 in my cash to go purchase it. And this was through years of setting up this process. So I saw him working in the fact that 2 weeks after that prayer, I got a phone call from one of the people that was on the bus. He'd take a microbus of people, and I lost communication with the driver. Then I get a call from a Greyhound bus station. One of the riders, one of the passengers, said that they got arrested in Nebraska. Yeah, and the driver coincidentally had a warrant out of the county that I was drug dealing. He never told me about that warrant, and so. It was very scary to hear that everybody except for my driver was released. And I immediately started to panic because this is now a federal case, right? Money like that can't be just transported, and there's going to be some questions, and those questions could lead right back to me. I met those guys at the Greyhound bus station in Nashville. And I got them to show me the paperwork that they had gotten from state of Nebraska. And the one that really made me shake was Department of Homeland Security. Because if it's over $100,000, then you have to involve the feds. So I felt as though imminent prison sentence, 25 years to life. I had a lawyer, and that's what he told me what I was going to be looking at. So that's what I was feeling, was the weight of that. And I was if dealing drugs was making me anxious, then feeling like you're gonna get raided by federal agents, that'll make you crap your pants. But in the midst of that, I also felt a strange peace, a peace that went beyond my comprehension and my understanding. It was almost God saying, "This is a storm, but I'm in your boat. Don't worry, trust me." And here's the cool part of the story. So after the money was gone, I had very little product left. And I called my financier who lived in Colorado. He had me on a large loan with a large amount of interest, like you would imagine in a criminal network. It's like going to a title loan place where you pay a payment and the balance remains the same. So I had owed him, I was still at a $30,000 debt to him. I called him, I told him what happened, and I told him that I was done. I mentioned that I prayed about it, and this guy is an atheist. And one of my partners, I called him as well. He was buying half of my inventory on a weekly basis. I called him. He lived in Davidson County. 2 days later, they showed up at my house in Davidson County, and they didn't treat me like the boss that day. They walked in my house, they sat me down in my living room, and they confronted me, telling me that I was going to continue doing this. The finance guy told me he would loan me another 100,000 to get another driver and to continue to pay off this debt. And my partner insisted that I manipulated him into this lifestyle and that I owed him. Well, at that point, the only thing I had was God to help me in that situation. And so I dropped to my knees in front of them. I closed my eyes and I threw my arms to the sky and I cried out for God over and over again. I left myself wide open for attack. And you know, guess what they did? They got up, they cursed me, and they walked out of that house. And I never heard from them again. That
Wow.
that's the foundation of my belief in God, and there's no other explanation in the world that these guys who didn't believe in God had the fear of God put into them, and they exited my life. And that's, you know, I doubted God for a little bit, but since that point in time, he's right here behind me. He's got my back all the time.
Wow, that's amazing. Now, what was your hardest part about walking away from your lifestyle that you built?
VIP everything, you know, $10,000 trips, unlimited drugs, prostitution, strip clubs, going into the mall and picking out anything I wanted. That was fun, you know. Like they say, sin is fun for a time, and then comes consequence.
Right.
You know, the allure of the money was great because it offered security, and but then I realized that that wasn't making me happy, so it all just lost its luster for me, and I started to see life completely different. And I wouldn't say I lost my ambitions, but my ambitions have changed from trying to retire early with millions in the bank and go on to sit on a beach and drink Mai Tais to I need to help other people find their purpose, and I believe that purpose is only rooted in God. I firmly believe that God created us for purpose, with talents to help other people with. And when you can do that, like you found your purpose, and it feels better than anything else in the world. And I believe that's the way that God engineered us, is that we are a funnel to help other people that, like we were talking, people that want help.
Right. It's so true. Now you describe yourself as a man transformed by God. What were the key moments of, or realization that solidified your faith during that transformation period?
You know, seeing that the Bible is not just a list of rules and regulations, but it's I started to see it as an instruction manual for a happy and a healthy life. people can read the Bible all day and they can think of who else this is going to help, but until you actually view it as an instruction manual for a happy life, then you start to apply those things, and it teaches us so much about sociology and psychology, how much alike we are and what drives us. And then I started applying that to myself, and I started seeing this growth from being a person with psychopathy who had no feelings and no emotions to somebody who could cry at a 30-second commercial about kittens. And the first time I actually could feel love again, it's still I was holding a child on my lap, and I was at church, and I was watching this child, and I started to feel something that I hadn't felt. And I was a married man, but I still didn't have these feelings. And when I felt love like that, I knew that I was on the right path. I knew it, that the Bible teaches us so much about life. You can read all the self-help books you want, and they're great to an extent, but this book was written by God through men to teach us about ourselves, to teach us to be happy, to be content. And when I started actually applying it and living it, it works. It absolutely works.
Wow. Now, many people struggle with the concept of redemption. What do you say to that someone who feels like their past makes them unworthy of grace?
Well, we'll define grace. Grace is giving somebody what they do not deserve.
Right.
So if you say I don't deserve this, then your answer is true, right? Because it's God given. And mercy is God not giving you something that you do deserve. For me, I deserve to be sitting in a prison, in a federal prison. But for some reason, God showed me mercy and grace. And I want to use my book and my life as an example of I'm the worst of these. I had addictions of crack cocaine, methamphetamines, club drugs, of using sex for approval. I've been homeless, I've been jobless, I've been in the worst conditions. And if you say that yours are worse, then all I can say is God's grace is greater than that. I've committed two abortions, so that makes me, in my mind, a willful murderer. And I did it not for the right reasons, but for reasons of selfishness. And I don't carry any of that pain anymore. I don't carry that past with me because as I gave my life to him and he came into my life, I became something new and I live that out every day. And so, yes, I do feel that past and I do feel that there's that shadow, but that's not who I am now. So if you're out there and you think that you're too gone, that you're too far gone for God's grace, I'll say, just look at his love for you. Just read in the Bible and you'll start to feel it. Open your heart up to him. And he'll fill in those gaps like a broken piece of concrete. He'll come in and fill them all in and make it new again.
I love that. Now, how has your faith not just transformed your actions, but reshaped how you see yourself, like your identity and purpose as a person?
My faith shapes my identity completely. I realized that I was made by him for him, and that makes my purpose for him so much different than personal gain. It's transformed my character, and spiritual growth, personal growth, is something that I put to the height of who I am. And I'm actually addicted to that growth. I'm no longer addicted to drugs. I'm addicted to spiritual growth now. So faith is believing in things that aren't seen. But as you grow closer to God, those things that aren't seen, you see them manifested through other people, through him working out things in your favor. When you're not praying for the lottery ticket to win, when you're actually praying for a brother or sister to be healed and it happens, it's the small things that I see that encourage and they strengthen faith. And I believe faith is like a muscle. You have to exercise it for it to grow, and you have to stretch it. And those times when you feel like everything's gone wrong, you put your faith in God, and he promises in Romans 8:32 that he will bring good out of every bad situation for those that love him. And that's a promise for his children. And my faith gets strengthened on a daily basis because I walk out on the ledge and I can't see step by step, but the word is the lamp to my life. So I walk in faith and the steps are illuminated. He doesn't say, I'll give you a spotlight for your life. He says, I'll give you a candle. And a candle only shows you just a step ahead of you. And it requires faith. And God wants that relationship with us, that we trust him in each step. And then he's the one that shines the next step. So it sounds hard, but he makes it easy. It's just like being in the care of a parent. It's not that hard.
Now, what do you think so many people self-destruct internally, even when they appear to be winning externally?
That false front, right? The front stage, but everybody's backstage is crumbling, right? It's that need, well, especially in our society today with social media and the lure of comparison, it strips you of your identity, of who you are meant to be. There's only one of you, there's only one of me. Even if you're twins, there's still only one of you. And God didn't make me to be like you or you like me. And so when we try to fit ourselves in other people's boxes, we end up confused and frustrated, and we feel less than when we compare ourselves in our looks and our treasures, and we become disillusioned. How could you not be unhappy if you're always looking for the next thing to fulfill your contentment? I think what it comes down to is a personal level of contentment. And yeah, I don't think that can be found in the world. I really don't.
I agree. Now, for you, what was the biggest emotional wound that needed healing, and how did your journey of transformation address it?
My biggest wound was my dad rejecting me over and over again. And the biggest healing from that was leaning into what God says about me. He says that even if your own mother and father reject you, I accept you. And that I started leaning into that promise, and I started leaning into the fact that I was not a mistake, that even before I was born, that he knew every hair on my head, that he chose where I was going to be born. Thank God I was born in the United States. He chose when I was going to be born, and he chose what talents I would be given with. And that was the biggest healing. When I stopped looking at the world for my approval, and I started looking at the creator of the universe, who, he's the boss. He's the best. So why I like me, God likes me. And if the world doesn't like me, what's their problem? It's not my problem. I'm focusing on personal growth and spiritual growth and getting better every day. And so if somebody rejects me now, I don't have a deep wound in it. I actually realize that that person is coming from a place of hurt. And then I want to help that person. So I pray for that person. I ask for opportunities from God to help me fix, help me help them if they want it.
I love that. Now, in your opinion, is it true healing possible without the reconnecting of one's spiritual side?
I believe that willpower can go so far. I believe that there's great benefits of AA and NA. I saw counselors, and I believe that does help. But I believe it always ends in a dead end where we're still missing something. There's a hole that we are all created with. And we can fill it with self-help books. We can fill it with Tony Robbins seminars. We can fill it with health foods. But eventually, you're still going to end up unfulfilled. And you can spend your whole life pursuing those things and be exhausted and constantly switching to the next book or the next fad. But ultimately, the satisfaction and contentment, I believe, only comes from a relationship with God. Is that hole finally was filled, and then I realized that's my identity. Now go pursue what he has built me to do.
I love that. Now, you've lived a life where most people can only imagine. Can you share one of the most surreal or intense moments from your time as a drug kingpin?
Oh yeah. So I'm dating a beautiful woman at the time who actually turned out to be my wife, and I really wanted to show out for her. She was very modest and not materialistic, a boho hippie kind of girl. Doesn't even wear any natural jewelry. So I wanted to show out. I wanted to impress her. So I took my main partner, who I spoke about earlier, he, my son, and this girl, Amber, to an all-inclusive trip to St. Thomas. And we stayed next to the governor of St. Thomas, and it was a 5,000 square foot house, marble floors, pool, and we had spending sprees. We did underwater diving with special helmets. We, relaxed on the beach. It was, a $10,000-$15,000 vacation.
Wow.
That's balling out. I bought a $6,500 watch while I was there. Bought some Gucci clothes. Living what they would say the Instagram lifestyle. And if I had taken pictures of myself then, I'd have been a social media hit, because it looked like the lavish lifestyle, had people serving you. I felt like the man. I felt like I was untouchable. And then sitting there on the plane ride going back to the States, I just had one of those moments of reflection where I realized that this beautiful woman who saw me for me would not be there if I got arrested. And I flat out asked her. I said, "What's going to happen with us if I go to jail?" And she said, "I'm not going to wait 25 years for you." And I said, "Okay." And I started crying, and I said to her, "I don't think I want to be a drug dealer anymore." And she was there wasn't a reaction like, "Oh, I'm missing out on the next Louis Vuitton purse," because she didn't want those things. She was thankful. And on a side note, what also felt good to me was going to the strip clubs and spending. I would spend $5,000 a night on just. I would go just so I can embarrass the other customers there, that when they would go throw money on the stage, that I would throw a handful of money on the stage, that all the girls would be sitting with me and my crew, and I just wanted to be that person, that man that everybody looked at. And money will do that. Money will do that for a time.
Right. It's so true. Now, were there moments where you felt fear or paranoia, knowing that risk came with your lifestyle?
Absolutely. Every single day I felt fear and paranoia, guarding every one of my steps. I had not only a smartphone, but I had two burner phones, and I had very strict rules with my customers. Everything I did, Stacy, was to protect myself. Every move I make, I was trying to be ahead of the police. But again, there's way more of them than there was me. And so it always felt like I was just about to fall in a hole. And so it was only when I was out of town on a trip that I actually felt some level of comfort in what I was doing. But that was, I could only be gone for about a week at a time, because the business was, I was the main cog in it. So I had to be there, and I had to be orchestrating all the moves. So it was not worth the money for the stress. I lost years of my life for the amount of stress that I faced.
Now, how did your perspective on those wild experiences change after your transformation?
Sin was fun, but I found that this life now is more fun. That living a simple life, it sounds dumb, like just going to work and enjoying good food and drink and enjoying the fruits of your labor. Like that sounds boring, but the Bible says that the simple life is the happy life, and that the flashy life is constant comparison. It's constant upping the ante. That the same trips are not going to make you happy. And so that's really what I found, is that the transfer, I didn't leave anything behind that I needed. I found it empty. So even if my book becomes a wild success one day, and I end up not having to do my regular job anymore. That's not going to make me any more happy or content than I am right now. And that's a bet on that. So I don't need the security of money anymore. I don't need the recognition and the fame. In fact, I didn't write this book to become famous. I'm already famous in my father's eyes. I don't need anybody to know my name, but this story is to help other people. So
Right.
that's why I'm doing it. I don't need anything. In fact, I could lose everything today. I could lose everything I owned, and I know that I woke up this morning with everything that I needed.
Yeah.
I don't need all that stuff, and there's so much security in that I don't need anybody's approval anymore. I don't need another pair of shoes or my hair done, or I don't need any of that. And there's so much contentment in that I wish other people could feel. I wish I could give you my heart, people out there listening, and just feel what it feels like to be wrapped in love and acceptance all the time. It's better than being a millionaire.
Yeah, that's so true. Now, today you volunteer in prisons and you lead Bible studies, an incredible contrast to your old life. What drives you to help other people, especially those in the darkest places?
Yeah, I do. I serve with a nonprofit called Men of Valor here in Tennessee, and they specialize in keeping guys from going back to prison.
Right.
So I started with serving young men, guys that at my age at 13, when I started to go the other way, I
Yeah.
want to start with them. And my goal is to give them information, give them knowledge, and disciple them into understanding the Bible and applying it. I'd rather have somebody that's foolish than somebody that's ignorant. I'd rather teach them and then let them make the decisions. But I didn't have that somebody when I was a kid,
Right.
and I want to stand in the gap. And so mothers who have, single mothers, mothers with boys that stop listening, they'll call me and say, can you help me? And I'm like, absolutely, I want to. And once I saw some traction with that, being that they hear where I'm coming from, they know I've lived a lifestyle, and so that lends them an ear to listen.
Yeah.
And God's given me this ability of influence. I used to use it to manipulate people, but now I use it to influence people. So once I started getting traction doing that, I got an opportunity almost 2 years ago to start going into the jails. And that's where I found my true audience. These guys, I speak the same language. I know what they're talking about, and they know that I speak truthful from a raw and honest place. And these
Yeah.
guys, it's like a spiritual greenhouse. Every week, these guys, 18 hours under spiritual lamps, and they grow and they read and they ask questions, and we have deep conversation. And so it drives me even more to learn and to understand what I'm talking about. Nobody knows more than the teacher knows, right? So
Right.
yeah, so it's so much more fulfilling. Every week that I go to those jails, it feels like it's my birthday. They're getting stuff, but I am getting the most out of it, because I walk out of there feeling like I just won the lottery, feeling better than when I used to get, the $15,000 payouts on a day. It
Yeah.
feels better than going to St. Thomas or Florida or any beach. It feels better because I'm doing what I was meant to do.
I love that. Now, what kind of responses do you get when you share your story with inmates or young men who may still be on the streets?
When I tell them that story about surrendering to God in front of those two men, that's the powerful story that I tell.
Yeah.
And it's a mic drop moment. And I got so many responses that have said, you need to write a book about your life. And after hearing that so many times, that was my response to that, is I believe my story can be helpful because it resonates with people. And so when I tell people that story, they seem to be drawn to it, and they see me as not a typical, like a Baptist preacher who's never drank alcohol and doesn't know anything about what it means to live on the seedy side. So Like they say, it takes one to know one. And
Yeah.
so I was one. And now I just want to hold people's hands and walk them to where I'm at, So that's awesome.
I love that. Has your mission ever led you to a breakthrough moment with somebody on the edge of self-destruction?
I've had people tell me that they've contemplated suicide. I've had people tell me that in the little things that's grown my faith, that what you told me today has helped me so much, and it was an answer to my prayer, which, and you never see those things coming. You see them in hindsight, but those little moments where I share my story in open and honesty and try to be transparent and try to be vulnerable. And that usually helps other people be vulnerable too.
Right.
And I've led so many men out of pornography addictions that are so frightened to talk about it with other people. And I
Yeah.
lead it with them. Like I was a porn addict. I was, and I go into detail of how I'm very raw when I talk. And I hope that being vulnerable helps that other person be vulnerable. Let me show you all my scars and my wounds, and that way you can open up, and it always helps. I mean, just recently, a guy opened up to me, a guy the same age as my son, and I just started asking him questions, and I started revealing my problems and my past and my addictions, and
Yeah.
why I did it. And he said, "Why are you talking to me about these things?" He said, I've been struggling with this so much." And he's crying on the phone with me, and now he's given up pornography, and he's asking me daily for Bible verses to encourage him. So those little wins, and you never know what you can say to somebody that can get them right off the edge of feeling that they have no value, and that
Yeah.
they that the world will be better off without them. And I'm here to say that's not true at all. You were created for a purpose, and you need to live it out. You need to find out what that is.
Yes.
And when you keep coming up empty, then go to God and you'll actually find it.
100%. In your memoir and your work, you emphasize that no one is too far gone for God's grace. Could you share a moment where you witnessed someone into that truth?
I was, I mentioned that I had been a part of two abortions, and I wanted to start doing something to give back, to save people from that ultimate pain that you
Yeah.
feel after that happens. So I started volunteering at the place where I actually paid for two abortions. And that means that I would stand on the outskirts of the business, and as people would come in, I would, I'm not holding a sign and yelling at them. I'm not belittling them. I'm not condemning them, because there is no condemnation from these lips, because I've already done it. It's, "Can I just talk to you for a minute?" And the guy's girlfriend had already went inside, and I'm begging this guy through the fence to talk with me. And he got out of his car, and there were some words of anger. But then when he heard my vulnerability about what happening, he said that there was nothing that was going to stop what was going on inside of there. But I offered him the forgiveness going forward from that. I talked to him that there is grace beyond sin, and that there's a God out there that loves him no matter what he's done. And that the guy was crying with me, and I could feel that my vulnerability gave way to some healing even before this had happened.
Yeah.
And again, I'm not condemning anyone that has, there's choices out there that we don't know about, where it seems like you do not have a choice. And I understand that too. So I just want people to know that there is a God that loves them. And if I can possibly help them before they make that choice,
Yeah.
then maybe I can offer some alternatives that they feel like they're backed in a corner. But that was one memorable moment that I had.
Wow, that's powerful. That's so powerful. Now, for those listening today who feel stuck and in destructive patterns, what would you say to encourage them to take the first step toward healing and redemption?
That's a good question. I think the first step is to be honest with yourself, to take a look at your life outside of yourself for a moment and think about where am I going? Where do I want to be? And why do I feel like I can't get where I want to be? And I would say that there's a word we use in Christianity. It's called repentance. And what that means is it's an honest and true desire to stop going the direction that you're going, to do a 180 and to go the opposite direction. And that direction would be headed towards God and purpose. And that's a really difficult thing to do, to come to terms to say, I am not who I want to be. Who do I really want to be? And I want to be at peace. I want contentment. I want to be approved. That is built into all of us. And are you tired of seeking it from the world, where that is fleeting at most? You might get fame and fortune for a moment, but then it escapes you. And I would say, look to God for who you are. Look to the instruction manual. When you get a big fancy stereo and it's got 50 buttons on it and you don't even know how to turn it on, what do you look at? You look at the instruction manual. And we have an instruction manual, and it's called the Bible. It's not rules and regulations. It's a pathway. It's a map to a good life. And God doesn't want to dominate your life. He wants to enrich it and give you abundance. And so that's what I would encourage people to do.
I love that. Now, what inspired you to write from Kingpin to Kingdom?
The stories, the inspiration from Kingpin to Kingdom was these stories, not just how I became a drug dealer, but all the gutter stories. This is where sexual addiction came from. This is where drug addiction came from. I was even in a hustle gang, so it's not just stories about drug dealing. Even though I kind of lay a blueprint in there, how I became a drug dealer step by step, but why I became a drug dealer and the psychology, which we all have in common. I'm just an extreme example of what happens when somebody has the ambition to fulfill rejection to a point that no one else has. I lost my fear, so I was able to do drug runs and all that. So there's some cool, intriguing stories in there. The story about how I met my wife and our first date when she found out I was a drug dealer. And so it's a story of redemption by using my life as an example of I believe I'm one of the worst people before I met God, and only cared about myself and my happiness. And the steps that it took for me to go from that lifestyle to where I'm at today, that's a map that I think that is we all can hold in common. You don't just have to be in the drug lifestyle to read and enjoy this book. It's I want you to see yourself in my book. I think we all have more in common than we think.
Oh, definitely. We definitely do. Now, how has writing and sharing your story helped you heal and deepen your faith?
I cried a lot. I cried a lot when I wrote that book, because I had to remember things that I wanted to forget. I had to again come to grips with the people that I had hurt and the people that had hurt me. I had to come to grips with what my father had done, and my father's passed away for quite a while now. He never saw me reach those goals of being a drug dealer. So it offered me healing, and it was painful at the same time. God gave me his spirit inside to help me write it. So it was a very fast process. I actually started writing the book this January, and it was released in May. So the the healing and the growth of actually writing something out. You know, like they say, writing is cathartic, and it's actually like a healing process. And then it was, you know, asking my wife, are you comfortable with me saying these things? Because I'm being very vulnerable to the world. You know, I'm talking about sexual addiction and pornography and prostitution and things that, you know, wives don't really want to hear their husbands talk about openly. But she gave me that grace of saying, yeah, you can. She did tell me to take out one chapter, so one that didn't need to be in there. Yeah.
Now, what do you hope readers take away from your memoir?
I want them to see themselves in this memoir. I want them to see that there is a life of contentment beyond comparison. I want them to see that grace is for everyone that will accept it, because grace is a gift, you know, and you can only get gifts by accepting them. I want them to see that God is not a tyrant, that God is not an unbeloved benevolent king, that he is good, and that he is his promises, you can take him to the bank, and that I've seen those promises come to life in my own life. And I want them to see my story and be attracted to God. I want God to be glorified through my story. I want them to feel the weight of God and say, like, if he can do that for this guy, then he can do that for me. Yeah. Moses was a murderer. Most people don't know that. King David was an adulterer and put somebody to death, one of his friends. The stories, all these heroes that you see in the Bible, the greatest New Testament teacher, Paul, he had people stoned to death. So God can take these murderer, adulterous, people that worship other gods and use them for his purpose. He uses the least of these people. If you think that nobody knows your name, then ask God to start using you. And the one who knows everyone's name will know your name and will call you friend. And that feels so good. That feels so good. So I've stopped living for that contentment from other people and that approval. And it's so freeing. I want people to have that.
I love that. I love that so much. Now, can you tell us if you had to take today's conversation and you wanted to emphasize on some important factors, what are some things you want people to remember from our conversation today?
I really want people to know that they have value, that they were created by God and for God. And in order to feel that value, you've got to lean into God and stop leaning into the world for you to hear it from the world. Because you may hear it, but it's fleeting and it'll be gone. And it won't fulfill you, to be honest. I want people to feel contentment. True contentment, where with very little or very much, that you're content, that you're not looking for the next thing, that you stop the when and then mentality. When I graduate, when I get the job, when I get the Porsche, when I get the 3,000 square foot house, when I get three kids, you will never be done with that. You will never be done with that mentality. And then you get to the end of your life and you're like, when I die, then what? No, I'm living my most fulfilled life right now, and I want people to realize that God created you and he sets your value. It's not the world, it's him. You need to be his child, and your value will never go down. It will never go down, and you can rest on that value.
That's so true. Oh, I love that. Now, for your book, where can people go to find your book?
Okay, From Kingpin to Kingdom is on Amazon. You can get it on the Kindle and paperback and hardcover. Don't bother getting a hardcover. I don't make any other more money off of that. It's the same. I'm trying to get it. Well, I've actually got it through Ingram. And so if you're out there at Target or Walmart or Barnes and Noble and you're an executive, ask your stores to start buying it, right? So it'll be on the bookshelves as soon as the stores start ordering it. Or you can go directly to my website. That's from kingpin to kingdom.com. and there's a link right on there. And I also offer several services on my website. Say I want to start traveling to prisons. I want to start doing group sessions at churches. I offer individual Zoom one-on-ones with people that like discipleship or they want to talk. And you can just reach out to me and I can pray for you for specific needs. So I'd like people to go to my website and check it out. I did spend quite a bit of time building it. It was tough. Never built a website in my life. So, that was fun.
And can you tell us again what your website is?
Yeah, of course. It's from kingpin to kingdom.com.
I love it. This has been amazing, Andrew. Thank you so much for coming on this show. You've accomplished so much in your life. You went through a lot of things in life. You searched for fulfillment. You went through a lot of obstacles in life. You did things that that you regret now, but you've overcome and asked for forgiveness, and now you put it behind you, and you're taking what you learned to help others, live a more fulfilled, life, that where they can live life and they can, really succeed and not stay in that area where they're around people who are going to pull them down and give them the opportunity to put themselves in situations where they can grow and they can f and fulfill their happiness and joy and really build and become the person they really wanted to be all their life. So I really commend you on everything you're doing, and thank you so much for coming on the show. I really appreciate you and everything that you've done. And you took an experience in your life, you turned it around, and now you're helping others. And to me, that's just priceless. So thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure, and you asked some really good questions and drove some things out of me that I didn't think we'd even talk about. So I just hope that people can find some healing in our conversation, find value in our conversation, and stop looking at the world for what you're missing.
Yeah.
Stop wasting your time and your money and your efforts that way.
I agree. Well, thank you so much, Andrew. I think this has been wonderful again, and you have a great day.
You have a great day. Talk to you later.
I do love you too.